Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome back to the second episode of our interview with retired detective and retired sergeant Jim Paydar from Chicago PD. We're here at the, as the promo said, in the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show and the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with not only with Jim Paydar, but my good friend and co-host Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Folks, if you remember, if you're dialing in from last time, if you're listening from last time, the last couple of three episodes, actually, you know a little bit of the story. But and just in case you have, are not coming back from previous episodes, one hot July, I think July the 2nd or 3rd, 4th of July weekend night in west side of Chicago, Illinois, couple of young detectives got dispatched out to check on some smelly drums, and the call was there was maybe a dead body in a drum, and they didn't really believe it, but they went out, and guess what they found? They found dead bodies in a drum. It was in a small sandwich shop run by a guy named Tony Russo, and it was owned by a man named Sam Rantis. And Sam Rantis, and talking to Tony Russo, they found out that Mr. Rantis was also dead already and been found in the trunk or in the back seat or the front seat, I'm not sure, found in his car at O'Hare National or O'Hare Airport a few months before that, I think maybe even the winter before that, and which is kind of interesting because the bodies were both dressed in galoshes and heavy winter clothes. There's two different drums. They weren't too sure if they were two different bodies or one body cut up into two different drums. So they wanted to dump them out on the floor. The district sergeant there did, and Detective Paydar had to appeal to a higher power, I believe a colonel or a Jim, are you there?
Deputy Chief.
Our good friend Jim Paydar's here, and they had to appeal to the deputy chief not to dump those bodies out on the drum. Now, Jim, I got on to you from your website. The website is a blog with a lot of good true crime stories out of Chicago. The title or the URL is www.onbeingacop. That's onbeingacop.
.com.
And it also is a book out there that was written by Jim Paydar and his son, Jay Paydar. And the title of it is On Being a Cop, and you can get that in his website, and he can send you an autographed copy. And if you like electronic books, why your usual places of finding electronic books, why you can find those there.
Now, Jim was working, I just made some notes here from when we talked with him here in the previous episode, and he was working in Area 4. He was on the homicide squad as a detective and had gotten a call coming into work essentially on at midnight or 12:30 on July 5th, and his partner, I guess who may have been senior, spoke up, and off they went to find whatever they hoped was maybe just a dead animal in a garbage can. Turned out not so much so.
So, Jim, we're up to the point where the bodies are not taken out of the drum and dumped on the kitchen floor. Thank God, because it would have destroyed any evidentiary value of anything inside those drums, or most stuff of evidentiary value. And you're gonna, where do you go with those drums next, and how do you get them there? You don't load them in the back of your police car, I'm sure of that.
No, we had a police squadron, a police wagon on the scene, and they just manhandled them with two or three guys and hoisted them up into the back of the wagon for transport.
I hope they didn't pick up any other...
We have a slight problem here because... Pardon me?
I hope they didn't pick up any prisoners on the way from somebody else that needed to transport in.
Did they seal the drums back up?
They put the covers back on the drums, yeah, but that didn't help much.
I mean, you'd hate to have it say, hey, we fought the sergeant to not put the bodies out on the floor in the kitchen to have them spill over on a hard corner in Chicago.
Yeah, that would have been kind of dicey.
Somebody have to sit back there with them to make sure they didn't go over?
You know, no, I think they were just about the width of the aisle in the wagon, so I don't think there was any danger of them tipping over, and I'm sure the wagon men didn't want that to happen either. They drove very carefully.
Yeah, because they would have had to clean it out.
Part of our problem was now, yeah... part of our problem was you can't take anything to the morgue unless it's pronounced dead. And we weren't quite sure what we had. So the wagon pulled up at the back door of the county hospital, and my partner and I went inside, and we said we had a stinker out in the wagon and would prefer not to bring it in. Did the doctor want to come out and... pronounce it out in the wagon, which they did very frequently. So they got this young resident, ER resident there. God, he was blonde, blue-eyed. He looked like he was about 19 years old. But he was a resident physician at the emergency room at County Hospital. And as we were walking into the driveway, we told him what we had. We had two drums. And we weren't quite sure what was in each drum, so we would like him to pronounce each drum dead. Drum one is pronounced dead at this time, and drum two is pronounced dead at this time. Well, he was a little bit officious. He said, no, I can't do that. He said, we have to know what's in the drums. So by that time, we got to the back of the wagon, and they opened up the wagon door, and it was a hot summer night, so the fumes came pouring out of the back of the wagon, and he was quite taken aback, but he had to, you know, he had to go and at least make believe he was looking in the drum, so he climbed up in the wagon and lifted the lid off of each drum, kind of waved his hand. He says, whatever is in each drum, it's dead. And then he came back down off the wagon and immediately squatted at the curb and proceeded to vomit for the next 30 seconds. And really felt sorry for the guy because he was a sorry-looking dude. By the time he recovered himself enough to stand up and hang on to the side of the wagon.
So that he could sign the paperwork.
So we told him, listen, we're going. Well, here's what we did. I says, hold the paperwork. I says, we're going to the morgue. The morgue was just like 100 yards away. When we empty these drums, we will figure out what we have, and we'll call you back, and you can do the paperwork, you know, whether we have one body or pieces of bodies or what, you know. So we did that. We went on over to the morgue. The next person we had to argue with was a morgue attendant. He wanted to know how many toe tags we needed. I says, we don't know. Maybe one, maybe two, you know. Well, you can't bring them in unless we know what you're logging in. And so we had a little tete-a-tete with that guy, but he eventually let us into the basement of the morgue, and we got two body trays, nice brand-new stainless steel body trays, and we positioned each drum at the end of the tray and just gently tipped it over and let it slosh out into the body tray. And we had, in fact, two bodies, but one of them was missing the legs from the knees down. And we thought, well, that's unusual. So we went back and checked the drums. The drums were empty. So we had one kind of heavyset guy who was intact, and we had another guy who was taller, but would have been taller except his legs had been chopped off at the knees. We called back the Cook County Hospital and gave the doctor the information. We had two John Does and no further information. He wrote up his paperwork. So then I called the office, my office, and I said, you know, we got two bodies here, but one of them is missing legs. And they said, did you are you sure that you didn't miss the legs? I said, I'm positive I didn't miss the legs. When we were at the scene, the deputy chief came in and looked at the scene, and, you know, one of the old things they tell you is always look up, always look up. And he came into this little storeroom, which had abnormally high ceilings, and he looked up, and he says, guys, be sure to check up there. I want you to check up there because there might be a knife, there might be a murder weapon, there might be something up there. So we said, well, aye, boss, we'll do that. So we had to dig around for a ladder that was tall enough to get up there, and the crime lab was griping about why we're looking up on these shelves, and we said, because the boss wants us to. And there was nothing up on the shelves. So we closed the place up, put the coroner's seal on it, and went about our way. So our office sent another team over to the corner sandwich shop, and they broke the coroner's seal and went in, and they looked down on the floor, and there was a Baby Ruth box, and they opened up the Baby Ruth box, and there were the two legs.
So my partner
and I could not believe that we had missed that.
Really?
I absolutely could not believe that we had missed it.
Were those the two guys that didn't take the first call?
No, this second team. This was another team. By this time, the day watch was coming on now.
Okay. It had taken that long of a time.
It was two guys from the... with the crime scene and the morgue and the Cook County Hospital and all that stuff really ate up some time. They brought the legs over to the morgue in the Baby Ruth candy bar box. At about that time, that's about all we had. The crime lab was able to lift some partial prints, but back in those days, we didn't have APHIS, and if you didn't have a full set of 10 prints, you were kind of out of luck unless you suspected who it was, and we didn't have any idea of who this was. One of the guys had three canceled checks in his pocket that had been made out to him, totaling $24,000, marked insufficient funds, and the checks had been written by Sam Rantis. We didn't know that at that particular moment because the checks were soaking wet from body fluids. They had to be taken to the crime lab and dried and photographed and everything. So at that point, we went back to the office to start our report. We had two unknown male bodies found in these 55-gallon drums and did not have much else to go on except we knew that the owner of the shop was dead, Sam Rantis. We looked up that case and we found out he had been found in the trunk of his car in the extended stay parking lot at O'Hare Field in February. He had disappeared December 7th, and we now start writing our report, and it was easy to write this report because no one came into the little room to bother us because they said we stunk to high heaven, and of course by that time we'd gotten used to it. But then the deputy chief stops by at the end of his shift, and he sticks his head and he says, what you guys got? So I briefed him, and I knew I had to tell him about the legs. But back in the back of my mind, I thought, it's because of you that we missed those legs, because you wanted us to check up on those shelves. But obviously you can't tell them that, you know. It's our responsibility. We missed them, and we're the ones who made the error. But I got to the end of the story, and I told him about the legs. And I said, boss, I says, we sure missed those legs, didn't we? And he looked at me for a moment quizzically, and I thought, oh, shoot. I says, he's not going to take this too well. And all of a sudden, he burst into a big grin. He says, yes, we did. Yes, we certainly missed those. So that was the end of that. But there's been a lot of conjecture, I know, on some of the blogs and some of the people who follow this stuff, what was the significance of the Baby Ruth candy bar box. And there was no significance except for the fact that Joey Grisafi was just too damn tall to fit into the drum. They didn't have any room left in the drum for the legs, so they wrapped them up in plastic and put them in a Baby Ruth candy bar.
What was the conjecture about? Was there was some symbol to the Baby Ruth candy bar box? I assume it's just a large cardboard box of which you could fit a lower part of a couple of legs in that was handy. Probably had bought a case of Baby Ruth candy bars. Was there
probably not on the top shelf?
Yeah,
empty
really.
Box. You know, they didn't get a ladder at the time. They got a couple dead bodies laying in the store.
So what's the conjecture on that?
Yeah. Well, it was just a box because it was a sandwich shop. They sold candy bars too, and they probably ordered their candy bars by the gross. Our conjecture is that this was the handiest thing around to put the legs in.
Okay.
And they probably weren't anxious to hang around any longer than necessary. And so they put the legs in the Baby Ruth candy bar and covered them up with plastic and put them in the floor of the storeroom. And looking back on it now, we feel that it's probably the legs that we're smelling, not the drums, because the drums were very tightly sealed. So it was the legs that kind of tipped people off to, God knows how long those drums would have been there if it hadn't been for that. From there, we started our investigation, and it was really a matter of backtracking, because we found these bodies on July 5th. Sam Rantis had disappeared on December 7th the previous year. His body was found in February of the following year. So there's bodies popping up all over, but we don't have any way to connect them. But once it hit the newspapers, we started getting phone calls from confidential informants and family members. And they told us that Sam Rantis had two other mob guys help him. And that was Billy Cascone and Jimmy Irwin. And so we said, well, that's interesting. So we go looking for Billy Cascone. Well, it turns out Billy Cascone is dead. He was murdered in February of that year. So we do find Jimmy Irwin. Jimmy Irwin's kind of a wise guy. He's one of those guys who don't tell you nothing, doesn't know nothing about nothing. And but he was the guy who got the other people pissed off. And he did this because when Billy Cascone was killed, Jimmy Irwin went to his wake with all of other Billy Cascone friends, and he was walking around the funeral home singing, "Roll out the barrels, we'll have a barrel of fun." And at that point, that was in March, nobody knew about the barrels. At least police didn't know about the barrels. Once the people found out that what the significance of the barrels were, they got really ticked off at Jimmy Irwin, and they started calling us with all sorts of information about when they thought it happened and that Billy Cascone and Jimmy Irwin helped Sam Rantis. One of the victims, Joey Grisafi, the guy with his legs cut off, we're looking for his car. We found out that his car had been towed from a street about a block away. And just on an off chance, this is a residential area, hardly ever tow cars. We went and searched through the dispatch cards, and we found a caller who had called on the car parked on a hydrant. And it was a woman we call in the book, we call her Sophia Conti. She had called several times, starting on the Saturday after Thanksgiving the previous year. So we went over and interviewed her, and she confirmed that she was the one calling, and she saw the two of them get out of the car, and she called them mafioso, and they were bums, and they were hoodlums, and she gave a couple of gestures indicating what she thought of them, and she says, "I called every day till they came and towed the car." So now we were able to pinpoint the day that the car was parked there, and that was a Saturday after Thanksgiving. So we were able to put the pieces together gradually, but a lot of it was so much backtracking, going back months about things that had happened that nobody were able to connect the dots on.
She called him a mafioso. I mean, why did she call them mafioso? Did she know who they were?
No, she didn't know who they were, but keep in mind, she lives in Little Italy.
So she just understood the look, the dress, the car, kind of car they drove,
yeah.
The way they parked kind of arrogantly in a fire hydrant.
Exactly.
How did you start getting on the fact this was a... how'd you get start getting onto the fact this was a mob kind of a deal? What led you down that path? Did you check with your intelligence unit, or how'd you go down that investigation?
Yeah, I'll tell you, the minute we found out that the owner of the shop was Sam Rantis, and a day or so later we got the IDs on the bodies as Sammy Marcello and Joey Grazafi, I got a call from an old high school buddy of mine who worked for the Secret Service. And he says, I just want to tell you, he says, Sam Rantis and Sammy Marcello were involved in a counterfeiting ring several years ago. And he says, we pulled a raid on a motel room where they were exchanging cash for the counterfeit, or checks for the counterfeit. And he says, Sam Rantis got pinched because at the time we got in the room, he's the one who had possession of the counterfeit. And he says, Sam Rantis went to jail for a couple years for counterfeiting. He says, he just got out a couple months ago. So the checks that were in Marcello's pocket, shirt pocket, were checks that Sam Rantis had written him for the counterfeiting money. Well, the counterfeit money was confiscated. Poor Sam Rantis went to jail for a couple of years, and now he gets out, and Sammy Marcello wants his money, which was for a deal that never went through. And so we surmise that somehow or other, Sammy Marcello and Joey Grazafi came to collect the debt. And I don't know if Rantis knew in advance or not, but at any rate, he was prepared with a .38 snub nose.
Now he was obviously
got the drop of him.
He was obviously ready for him. Did I guess? But he's dead now. So do you go take a look at why is Sam Rantis dead?
Did you?
Well, because my buddy. From Secret Service connected the dots between Marcello Grazafi and Rantis, and we figured now that they were tied up in this counterfeiting ring, so that started leading us to think that this all had to do with the mob in Chicago. The other thing is, we were looking for Billy Cascon, and we found out he had been killed. So those are kind of major clues. That you're dealing with a mob situation here. The only one involved in this whole incident at the time of our investigation was still alive was Jimmy Irwin, and he wasn't telling us anything. But we were able to piece together enough evidence and enough witness accounts from neighbors in the neighborhood and Sophia Conti, and we put together quite a detailed case detailing that Sam Rantis was most likely the killer, and Sam Rantis was now dead. So we took that before the coroner's jury, and the coroner's jury returned a finding that this was murder by Sam Rantis, now deceased. So we got our case cleared. And like I say, at the conclusion of this whole thing, strangely enough, the only one who was still walking and talking was Jimmy Irwin. But a year after that, he got mowed down on the north side. They really filled him full of bullets on North Halsted Street. So he was the last one of the group to die. But everyone hit the cemetery on this one.
Really? Now, did your sources, your informants, and anybody come up with any ideas about? I mean, why was Sam Rantis killed? Was it a retaliation for the killing of Grazafi and Marcello? Or was there something else going on that you didn't even know about? Were you able to learn anything about the murder of Sam Rantis and Cascone? Were they just simply revenge killers?
Here's what the situation was. We feel that... Marcello was just the middleman for the mob, trying to collect his $24,000, which really wasn't going to be his. He was going to go take it up to whoever up the line. And when Sam Marcello and Joey Grazafi disappeared, we feel strongly that the hierarchy knew where their call was, where their last call was, and their last call was at Sam Rantis's place. And so it was just very shortly after that, like about 10 days later, that Rantis disappeared. He showed up a couple months later out at O'Hare Field in the trunk of his car. Who killed Sam Rantis? That's still a mystery.
So
we don't know who killed Sam Rantis.
All three of them were killed, so, I mean, somebody had to have talked, especially for the other two to be killed pretty quickly. Maybe Sam Rantis, they tortured him a little bit, and he told Don Casconi, or Casconi and, I can't remember the other guy's name, Irwin, did they go out and just blab it around?
Somebody. Yeah, that's what happened, is Casconi and Irwin started talking around the family and the people about how they helped Sam Rantis with these drums. They were shooting off their mouth, and they shouldn't have been. So early on, before the drums were ever found, Billy Casconi got killed. And then at his wake, Jimmy Irwin is walking around the wake singing, "Roll out the barrels, we'll have a barrel of fun." And the people there who knew about this thought that was very distasteful, but they didn't quite know what it meant until July when we found the drums. And that's when some family members really got ticked off. And they called us confidentially and told us everything they knew. They wouldn't give witness statements, but they pretty well pointed to Casconi and Irwin helping Sam Rantis dispose of the bodies. Now, the question remains, what was Sam going to do with those drums?
That's a good question.
He got interrupted in his disposal activities. He got interrupted by being killed. We don't know what his plans were for those drums, but they sat there for several months before anyone found them.
Well, and they had sat there for at least 10 days from when the two guys were murdered, and they didn't let the bodies lay around. They put them right in the drums and put them back there, and then 10 days later, Sam Rantis disappears himself.
And there was some speculation that Harry Aleman killed Sam Rantis. Had you heard that?
No, we haven't. It might be very well possible. Sam Rantis, so we divided the city into six detective areas. Sam Rantis was killed up in Area 6. So that was really not our case. Because of the fact his body was found up there, we didn't have any interest in solving it or following through on it. We move our own X's and we keep our own statistics for our area. And it's kind of a little competitive thing, you know, what area has the most clear-ups and so forth. But Sam Rantis, outside of the facts that he was found on this date and he disappeared on this date, and those were interesting facts to us, but who actually killed him did not interest us at that point.
Oh, you got your clearance, so you'll move on to the next homicide. You got 10 more of them lined up by then.
Yeah.
You were more worried about Marcello.
Yes, we did.
And how do you pronounce his last name? Grisafani?
Grisafi.
Marcello and Grisafi.
Grisafi, because those were actually the guys that were dead in your area. Now,
were the two homicides we were charged with.
When you were there.
And by getting the coroner's... By getting the coroner's jury to rule that it was homicide by Sam Rantis, then we did what we call an exceptional clear-up. So we were able to clear both those homicides.
And close the cases that way.
So from that standpoint, for Area 4, it was a success.
I'm just kind of curious. You know, the 55-gallon drums are pretty big, and if they obviously one guy a little bit smaller, they could fit his whole body in without cutting the legs off. The other guy, who was Grisafi, Grisafi, a little bigger, so they have to take his legs off. Was there never any figuring out of, did they use like a circular saw or, and then the other question I really have, besides the weapon they'd use to do that, would be, why didn't they just fit the legs in the drum with him? He was just that big?
Yeah, the drum was pretty full. He was a big guy. Joey Grisafi was a tall guy. My guess would be that at this point in the game, Billy Casconi and Jimmy Irwin don't want to hang around there too long. They're helping this guy out. They're messing with some bodies. They cut the legs off. You know, and one thing, Jesus Christ, what are we going to do with these legs? Well, here, we'll just put them here. Let's get out of here, you know. They didn't want to hang any longer.
You couldn't tell?
Some speculation.
You couldn't tell?
Pardon me?
You couldn't tell what they used to cut off the legs? Was there an implement there that...
No, the decomposition was so severe after 9 months in the drums that it was very... They both had been shot in the head, and we were able to determine that from x-rays, and they retrieved the bullets, and we determined it was probably from a .38 snub-nosed revolver. Never found the gun. There was some speculation that the actual night of the murder of Grassafi and Marcello, that Rantis had put them in the walk-in cooler they had. Now, at that point, we don't know which came first, the body or the drums. Did he have the drums ready? Was he ready? Was this a planned thing? I probably think it wasn't planned. So the being it was a holiday weekend, the bodies may have been in the walk-in cooler for a day or two before he got Cascone and Irwin over there to help him. What he planned to eventually do with the drums, God only knows.
So were the drums
interrupted in his?
Were the drums brand new? I mean, had they? You think they
yes.
were? So he went out, he killed them, put them in the cooler, and went out and bought the drums and got those other two dudes to come over. Is would be your speculation?
And there's a place about half a mile away at that time that made these drums. We went over there and talked to them if they could tell us anything about who bought just individual drums. And they said there was no way they could trace that back. He says, people come in here all the time and buy a drum or buy two drums or buy three. And this was like 9 months before. So, they wouldn't have any idea who they sold those to. But most likely those drums came from that particular shop. But there's no identifying marks on the drums. No way we could trace them back to that place, although my guess would be that's the closest place where you could buy those. And so that's probably where Rantis bought them.
Now, and the...
So there's a lot of...
When we did the episodes before, we got a chance to talk with you, and we just had the notes there that we kind of went through. A question I would have was, what about Grassafi's and Marcello's families? They had contacted and made a request for an appearance of their relatives as a missing person, had they not in December. How did that kind of play out in terms of...
Early in December, the families of Marcello and Grassafi served a writ of habeas corpus on the FBI because they thought that their family members were in FBI custody. And the FBI, of course, didn't have them, didn't know anything about them, and so that went nowhere. And then shortly after that, Sam Rantis disappeared. And he just disappeared on December 7th and was not found until February 24th the following year out at O'Hare. Now, interestingly enough, the families of Grassafi and Marcello never reported them missing until Sam Rantis' body was found out at O'Hare Field. The day after Sam Rantis' body was found, the Marcello and Grassafi families filed missing persons reports on them.
So,
but it's interesting that they let that go for like 3 months.
Yeah, they knew. They knew that the outfit had taken care of the suspect, so they went ahead and reported them as missing. It would be my guess on that.
Yes.
And then at that point, though, there's a missing persons report filed, which you had nothing to do with because you were in homicide. But come July, after you identify who these two bodies from the drums are, how do you go about contacting the family?
Once we've determined their identity, we did come up with the two missing persons case reports, and those were suburban cases. Notified the suburban departments that these two people had been located, and they were now at the Cook County Morgue. And then our teams went out at that point and interviewed the families. And through a series of interviews with various family members, some of them began to feed us little bits and pieces of information that allowed us to tie everything back together again.
So in this subculture of the Chicago outfit, everybody who was in the know, and the family included, knew what happened. They knew the whole story. And so they just fed you out enough.
They knew something had happened. I don't think they knew the details. And they knew that there were some 55-gallon drums involved, but they didn't know where they were. And they knew that Cascone and Irwin had something to do with it. And then once the bodies were found in the drums, then they were really ticked off because Jimmy Irwin was going around whistling the Burr Barrel Polka. They thought that was rather distasteful, even for mob families.
You know, just listening to you describe all of this, I mean, in kind of the order that people were kind of killed, you know, if you're pointing a finger at a snitch, it sure sounds like Irwin, even though he got his. You know, he seemed awful confident that with the death of Cascone and of Sam Rantis, that somehow him still being alive was kind of a foregone conclusion. And obviously in a hail of gunfire, he dies as well, which probably was not an accident.
Plus, he was so cocky. He was so cocky getting away with singing that "Roll Out the Barrel" at the guy's wake. You know, if I were to speculate on this, I would say he went. He told the mob guys exactly what happened, thinking that he could cover himself and let them take their revenge.
I think you're exactly right.
Well,
I think he felt that by tipping them off to what happened, that he was in the clear now.
When Sam Rantis disappeared, I mean, his body, we could talk about the nature of how they murdered him, but you would think that they wouldn't just, you know, they would question him first. You know, obviously they were missing a couple of their known associates, and they would want to know where they were at, and using aggressive techniques, you would think that Sam would probably have knuckled under and told them where those 55-gallon drums are. Instead, his body's just disposed of and left at the O'Hare Airport. And months and months and months go by before all of this, you know, is unveiled.
Yeah, you know what? The only thing that doesn't match up there is that I suppose that the families were not in the know, where they filed a writ of habeas corpus for the FBI to release Marcello and Grisafi. But that was probably the attorneys for the family, and they were at that point not in the know, so...
Yeah,
but it's interesting that they did not report their family members missing until Sam Rantis' body was discovered in February.
Yeah, for the family, the actual blood family, it's pretty important to find the bodies. And it seems to me, like Aaron said, I'm kind of surprised that they didn't get Sam Rantis to tell about what happened to the bodies, but maybe the outfit didn't really want those bodies found for some period of time. I don't know. But it's like they knew, I guess, I don't know, because Rantis knew that they were in the back room. He's the only guy, him and Cascone and Irwin knew they were in the back room. Those three knew. But nobody told anybody or did anything.
Cascone never apparently talked either, because they found his body, and it was still, once again, months later before they find... Marcello and Grisafi. It seems to me that the two of them didn't talk, and to the degree that Irwin was still alive, obviously he wasn't saying anything, because it was much longer after that that you found these barrels and the bodies that Irwin dies himself.
Well, it'll always be a mystery, I think, why the family wasn't somehow, somebody didn't tell them, hey, go look in the storeroom of the sandwich shop, and they could at least make an anonymous phone call and have somebody go find those bodies, so the families could have their loved ones' bodies and have them, you know, have a funeral and buried.
Sam Rantis was found, instead of often people in these situations, their bodies never found. Maybe that was one of the reasons that they, rather than just dispose of the body and nobody finds it, they left it there as a message or something.
Here's my thought on that. Cascone and Irwin helped Rantis put the bodies into the drums, and maybe they even sealed them up with the bolt rings and everything, probably in the walk-in cooler. And that may have been the end of their involvement. Rantis could have, with a hand truck, could have put those drums in that back room and stacked up the bread racks And it could have been very likely at that point in time, Rantis was the only one who knew where they were.
You know, that makes sense, Jim. I'm glad you, because I've been kind of perplexed about this since I first read it. I know here in Kansas City, we had a mob guy that they killed, and they disappeared him. They did something with his body. But the family, who and they were all, it was like one of those mob families that were, everybody was close. It's kind of a small community, as you know, in the Chicago outfit. It's in the, each crew especially, it's a pretty small world. And the family was notified via an anonymous phone call to a police detective to go take a look in a trash can, and they found the guy's clothes that he was wearing when he was last seen. So the family knew then he was dead, and then he was never going to be found. So, you know, it's it was kind of perplexing to me why as many people should have known about this, that somebody didn't tell the family so they could find the bodies. But that's a good, that would be a logical, good logical explanation, that Sam was the only one that knew for sure, and they just killed him.
Yeah, I think that's the way it worked out. We had, there were some teenagers that worked at the sandwich shop, and they reported, now of course everyone's going back in their memory now, 9 months back, but they do recall some 55-gallon drums being back in the kitchen somewhere around the holidays, but they didn't know whether it was before or after. They didn't have any knowledge about what they were used for, and then the drums one day just disappeared. They weren't there anymore. And being teenagers working in a sandwich shop, they, you know, and being in Little Italy, you don't ask too many questions.
Sam Rantis, he obviously, with his background in forgery and having come out of serving some hard time, had not talked and had not, you know, not lightened his sentence, if you will, by providing information. Do you think that maybe, I mean, maybe that's why he, obviously it was illegal for him to carry a snub nose, but do you think maybe he was anticipating this happening because of the fact that he'd given him some checks in exchange for counterfeit money, and at the end of the day, all the guy had was some bad checks and no counterfeit money.
Yeah, Sam got the raw end of that deal for sure, Sam Rantis. But for somehow or other, Marcello felt that he was cheated also. But he was only cheated because he didn't get the money that he went for. The money was still in possession of Sam Rantis when the Secret Service burst in on the room. But as far as a snub nose, with the gun laws in Chicago at that time, he would have no permit or no permission to be carrying a gun. But that doesn't mean anything to the mob guys, you know.
Right. That kind of a guy will just have one hidden away just in case. As they say in the penitentiary, better to be caught with than without.
And he may have had it in the shop for protection of the shop, too. Who knows, you know.
Can you say how long it was from when he was, I guess, paroled to when he disappeared? Do you have a recollection of his approximate parole time?
You know, I could dig out the files and look it up, but I want to say probably less than 6 months.
6 months, yeah, not a very long time at all.
From the time he got out to the time this whole thing went down.
I mean, if these guys were connected with the mob, they probably would have known that he had gotten out.
Yeah, this is probably not their first trip over there trying to collect on those bad checks, that $24,000. It was probably their second
trip.
Yeah,
that was my
over.
Thought, too.
And they weren't necessarily
acting. They may have actually called him and said, listen, we're coming over this afternoon. You better have the money.
Yeah,
said,
that makes sense.
Well, I don't
sense.
Have the money, but I got a snub nose.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think he was ready. I think he was. He had a half-formulated plan for when they got there, because he would have had to, like, make sure nobody else was there. You know, lock the door on the shop after they came in so nobody'd walk in on them, or just take the risk that somebody'd walk in on them.
It was Thanksgiving, right? Because of the tow lot.
Yeah, it was Thanksgiving.
This was Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Well, he should have been open that day. Yeah. He must.
Apparently didn't celebrate Black Friday back then.
Really?
But at the same time, a half-formulated plan.
Did have
a half-formulated plan.
Well, that was it. See, I don't think he thought it all the way to the end, and then he got interrupted. But we did have a witness from the neighborhood who on that Saturday came over, and the shop was open, but the front door was locked. And he was friendly with Sam Rantis. They used to sit and shoot the bull and visit about old times and everything. And this, he was a young man. He wasn't, to our knowledge, he wasn't involved with the outfit at all. We checked his background pretty thoroughly, but he came over there on that Saturday evening, early evening, and the door was locked, but the lights were on. So he kept knocking at the door, and he was thinking something was wrong with Rantus. So he kept knocking and kept knocking, and Rantus came from the back room and went up to the front and said, open the door just a crack. He says, we're closed. You can't come in now. He says, I'm just saying hi, Sam. No, you can't come in now. We're closed. And he shut the door. He says, and he was very upset. And he said, I thought, well, that was strange because we're friends. You know, I just come over to talk. So that was all on that same night. So we figured at that point, Grisafi and Marcello were probably in the back room, alive or dead, one way or another.
Yeah, good question. Aaron said, why didn't Sam go ahead and leave town or lay low? Yeah, you have any speculation on that?
No, I don't. I think he had, I don't know, he had some sort of plan, and we were not quite sure what it was. He was a married man, and he had roots in the community. I don't know what his thinking was.
Yeah, he probably just figured he'd tough it out.
And
maybe he thought
he toughed it out.
Maybe he thought he was that good of a counterfeiter. I mean, these guys didn't show up because they engaged him to do counterfeiting. They were working on behalf of somebody else.
There's the tale.
All right. Well, that's great. That's that brings a lot more life to the tale that I was able to bring to it. And this will be an interesting three or four part episode series. We'll make sure that you know when it's going up, and we'll link to your website.
Yeah, please do.
We'll link to your website, and let's just go back over this one more time. Jim, you and your son, Jay Paydar, are Chicago police officers, although you're now retired. And you you exchanged emails telling your police stories, which is kind of half the charm and the interest in your book and your blog, I think. These are first-person stories. These are, as Aaron would say, these are stories from the mouths of the men who did it, which is something we try to do on this show. We've had a couple, three criminals, and we've had several policemen on here, and we try to get the story from the mouths of the men who did it, and your blog and your stories are exactly from the mouths of the men who did it. And what I find interesting from, of course, I'm a retired police officer myself, is that you add some family stories in there to kind of, add another dimension to the policeman, not just somebody that puts on the uniform or straps on the gun on his side and goes in and does daring deeds and then goes back in and goes back up on a shelf. We got lives outside of that job, and so I'm glad you did that. I'm looking forward. I got a copy of your book. You sent it to me. I appreciate it, and I will get started on that over this weekend, more than likely. Folks, you can find
this
book. Very
good. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Folks, you can find this book, autographed copy, and the blog at www.onbeingacop.com. That's onbeingacop. And order one of those. If you have to have an electronic book, then you can go to your electronic bookstore and whatever you prefer. I think, Jim, you said Nook and Amazon and probably Barnes & Noble and all the places that sell e-books.
Yeah, iTunes.
iTunes.
It's available in every format known to mankind.
Yeah.
But a hard copy will get you an autograph.
And now we're going to have a story from it right out of the mouth of the man that wrote it and lived it. And Jim, we'd like to have you come back one of these days, and let's tell another story from your career as a homicide detective. Would you like to do that sometime?
I'd be happy to. I'd be honored to.
All right. We will do that. We've got two or three that we're working on right now. And as I said, we're kind of primarily mob-oriented, but we've done a couple, three serial killers and some other kind of crimes. I did one on the Ku Klux Klan investigation I did here in Kansas City. And we did one on a real recent crime the other day. Not too long ago, it's up right now. It's called the Superbike Murders. It was a really fascinating story. As a detective, you'll appreciate this. There was four people at a motorcycle shop were killed and no suspects. For 13 years, they did not solve it. They had a lot of twists and turns of it. Nobody solved it. 13 years later, a girl and her boyfriend go missing, and the investigation finds the girl chained by the neck in one of these truck metal containers, and they find out from her that this guy who did this to her, she had worked for him, and he owned that property, and he had killed her boyfriend and buried his body and killed a couple other people and buried their bodies. And so they arrest that guy, and he admits to killing the four people at the motorcycle shop 13 years before. And the information I read on said he gave enough details about the crime scene that the police in South Carolina, close to Charlotte, South Carolina, and the police are convinced that he did do that superbike murder just because he was mad at him. So, we do all kinds of stories, and I know you've got a whole bunch of good stories in there about interesting, unusual crimes. So thanks a lot for being here.
I got a couple ideas for you going down the line.
All right. We got it. We're in email contact. Let's work on those ideas, and we'll get those going sometime over the winter, early spring.
Gary, it's been a real pleasure, and I'm very happy that you were able to contact me, and I'm honored that you saw fit to do a program.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Good night.
That was amazing once again, from the mouth of the men that did it.
Really. You know, this brings us to my usual public service announcement. I have long supported a nonprofit called First Call. If you have a friend, relative, loved one who has a problem with drugs or alcohol or any kind of addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. It's a 24-hour-a-day answered hotline. And even if you are from out of the area, you can call them and ask them where you might find resources in your area. They also have a website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
And remember to buy or rent the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. And download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. If you're in Kansas City, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And remember to put a hit out on our donate button. Freedom Information Act requests are not free, and we could use your support.
Good night, folks. Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.